This is Steve James, the director of Life Itself, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio.
Everybody, this is Adam Chartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio. We're leading up to a Labor Day holiday weekend. Oh my goodness, the summer is coming to a close. It's hard to quite fathom that, but it's true. And just hours away from going upstate myself, I'm going to go upstate grabbing my punk son, and we're going up to the Finger Lakes. That's one thing we do. We go up to the Finger Lakes, and we're going to hang out for about 4 or 5 days and just chill out. That's what we're doing. You guys need to do the same thing. You need to chill out and relax and take off some time and just sort of be in the moment. Enjoy those last hours because we're hitting the ground running in the fall, and you know how that gets. So please do focus. Bring it to a standstill for a minute. Stop texting and tweeting just for a minute. And just be in the moment. Be with your closest and your the people that matter the most. That's my little bit of advice. But, you know, I always get this way sort of right around this time of year. Okay, here's the Roger Corman story. And then we'll talk about episode 311. Okay, the story. Roger Corman, I'm going to say it's lofty, but I'm going to say he single-handedly invented independent film. I know that's not true, but let's say he's one of the pioneers. I mean, you know, just work with me here. Now, as many of you know from listening to the last episode, the story was I got in touch. I found out that he was going to make a couple of appearances at the Film Anthology Archives, which is a repertory art house in the East Village of New York City. And they often have retrospectives and a lot of films that don't get seen in other places, let's put it that way. A lot of experimental films, too. But also, they'll do things like, for instance, they're doing this retrospective of films from AIP, which stands for American International Pictures. Roger Corman ran that company for many years before he sold it, and, you know, he started New Horizons. It's a company that he saw, and then he eventually sold. But they were doing this retrospective, and it's a lot of B-movies, like movies that would play at drive-ins, that kind of thing, meant for teenagers. Anyway, he brought back the careers of Bela Lugosi, Vincent Price, and did a lot of horror films, and then eventually science fiction and teen romance, you know, all those things. Then into the 60s and 70s with the motorcycle films, Peter Fonda, Jack Nicholson, Dennis Hopper, all those guys, and then hired filmmakers like Francis Ford Coppola, and Jonathan Demme, and Joe Dante, and Alan Arkush, and who else? Many others. Peter Bogdanovich, all these people, James Cameron, all these people pass, Ron Howard, yada, yada, yada. All these people pass through his company. Anyway, I found out they're doing this retrospective at the Film Anthology Archives, and I reached out to my colleague, Jed Rapfogel, who is a programmer over at the Film Anthology Archives. And, you know, I said, Jed, look, let me do a segment of the podcast devoted and dedicated to this retrospective you're doing. We'll bring you on. We'll bring on Roger Corman. And he tried as hard as he could. Now, Roger Corman, he's coming into New York. He's 89 years old. People are going to pounce. They're going to try to get to Roger Corman because he's a lot of people are going to want to talk to him. So Jed tried, bless his soul. He tried. He sent a number of emails to the folks over at New Horizons in L.A. and didn't have a lot of success with it. He kept bringing it, and he'd get back to me. And he says, look, I'm trying. They're not responding to my request to have you do an interview, Adam. So I said, listen, I was going to reach out regardless to their office and just introduce myself, call up and introduce myself to the office. Anyway, and Jed said, well, he emailed me back. I'm not 100% comfortable with it because, you know, I don't want to overwhelm them with this. And I said, listen, you know, respectfully, I was going to do this regardless. It wasn't like I just thought I should go through the Film Anthology Archives because, first of all, they were way overdue. I have not done anything with the Film Anthology Archives since I started the podcast, and it's long overdue. And secondly, you know, you're organizing this retrospective. I should go through you. But if not, I still feel like I should take advantage of this very rare opportunity. He's 90 years old, or he's turning 90 in a few months. Who knows when Roger Corman's going to be back and, you know, able and willing to do something like this. So I didn't hear back from Jed. And I kind of felt uncomfortable because I didn't want to alienate, you know, I didn't want to alienate him. I didn't want to alienate Film Anthology Archives. You know, it's got the history. Una Meckes is a friend of mine. She's the daughter of Jonas Meckes, who's, you know, one of the founders of Anthology. Anyway, so I have a lot of respect for the organization. But I thought, you know what, though? I got to try. So I call up a week or two ago, I call up Roger Corman's office. And I get his assistant, his executive assistant, lovely woman named Cynthia. And she says, write me an email and just tell him what you're telling me. You know, you're a champion of independent film. You want to visit Rob. He does these types of things. He enjoys it. Just try it. So I wrote an email. I didn't hear back. A bunch of days later, I emailed back that, oh, I just had Jerry Schatzberg on. We talked about Roger. And then I get an email back saying, Roger's going to be in the Standard Hotel, East Village. I can say this now because it's past tense. What you need to do is call Roger on Friday at the hotel. So all morning, I'm calling the hotel on Friday morning, and nobody's picking up at the hotel. Very odd. I know I'm getting the right number. For some reason, though, the hotel is not picking up the phone. Isn't that weird? So finally, it was noon or later, and they pick up. The reception picks up. I ask for Roger Corman's room. I'm connected. I'm excited. And I get a woman answers. It's his wife. And she's tries to talk. And she's like, oh, wait, hold for Roger. And I'm all of a sudden, I'm on the phone with Roger Corman. And I'm like, you know, go. I'm like, Roger, can we do this thing? And he's like, I'm very busy. Call me tomorrow. So I'm like, okay, I'll call you tomorrow. Well, what time? 11 o'clock. Okay, sure. 11 o'clock. I'm thinking to myself, I tried at 11 today. And I couldn't get through the hotel. How do I know tomorrow, Saturday, that I'm going to have any more success? So I thought to myself, you're going to go to the hotel and you're going to wait there. So that was the plan. Now, I'm winding down here, I promise. At the same time, I already had this young filmmaker named Kent Moran, who was supposed to come over to Brooklyn to visit me to do a podcast interview regarding his new film called The Challenger. So I said, Kent, change of plans. Meet me at the Standard Hotel in the Village and you're going to help me, and you're going to meet Roger Corman probably, and then we'll do, you and I will do our own podcast after that. And he was like, cool, let's do it. So the following morning, instead of calling Roger and waiting for the reply or waiting for the hotel not to answer the phone again, I went into the East Village, to the Standard Hotel. And as I'm on the subway, Kent is saying, I just got here. Roger and his wife are in the cafe. I'm standing right next to their table. They're having breakfast. And I'm like freaking out. I'm like, I got to get there before these guys leave, you know? And I did. I got to the hotel just in the time. And then I'm like, should we? This is like, for me, this is a huge thing, you know? For you, you're probably thinking this guy's insane. But for me, this is like Roger Corman. It's like on the Mount Rushmore of independent film, there's Roger Corman, right? Who else is on the Mount Rushmore? We'll get to that later. But okay, so there he is. We're standing at the bar a few feet away from his table. And I'm like, should I ambush him? Like, should we wait till he's finished eating and then like cut him off? Or should I let him get up to the hotel room and call him once I know he's up there? I didn't know. But as soon as he paid his bill, which was like a minute later, I just sort of, you know, he's walking right by. I said, Mr. Corman, you know, then he remembered who I was from the call yesterday. His wife remembered me. And so therefore he said, look, I don't have much time, but let's go. We'll sit down for 10 minutes. We'll do the podcast. That's right. So we sat down and we did the podcast. Kent was there. So he shot the thing. He got video with my phone. We got photos. It was fantastic. A couple of things happened. One thing is I was caught off guard. I thought, you know, I was going to prepare for it. I ran out of batteries on my recorder, so I had to, fortunately, I was able to plug it in, and, you know, we salvaged it. Of course, I had a great time. At about 10, 15 minutes into it, I called it off. I said, listen, thank you for your time. I want to respect your request just to give me a few minutes because I know you're busy. I cut it off. And so basically what I'm saying, folks, is after that long story, is next episode, you're going to hear my conversation with Roger Corman, who is this huge icon of independent film. This is, for me, an enormous thing. So Roger Corman, it's fairly short. I would love to have him on, but he did invite me to continue the conversation, albeit on the phone, but we're probably going to do it because, you know, you got to do it. Got to get the full story. Got to ask all the great questions. That's the story. Okay, episode 311. This is a jam-packed episode, and it's a good one. We have on Stanley Nelson, who has been in the business making documentaries for decades. He has a new documentary about the Black Panthers. It's, in fact, called The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. It's going to be at the Film Forum here in New York City, starting this Wednesday, the 2nd of September. It's going to run for 2 weeks. Starting on September 11th, it'll be at the AMC Magic Johnson Theater in Harlem. But in the meantime, let me just tell you, it's also going to be rolling out all over the country in 20 different cities, guys. Go to the website, theblackpanthers.com, and it's all there. And if you live in a city where it's playing, one of those 20 cities, I have to tell you, there's all these different events going to happen and different speakers and different guests. And Stanley Nelson, it will be at all 20 cities. And he's going to talk about that in this coming conversation. We met at the Firelight Media offices up in Harlem. They've got a beautiful brownstone up there. And we met and talked there. It was a little curtailed because Stanley had double booked. His wife's birthday was that evening, and he was supposed to be meeting her for dinner. And I felt terrible that I was holding him up, but he was very kind, and we knocked out this conversation about this very special documentary, again, called The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, which has the participation of a number of former Black Panthers. And is a very extensive and well-rounded story, their story. So go check it out. Okay, and then before Stanley, we're going to be talking to Michael Beach Nichols. You may remember him. He was on before with Flex is Kings, a dance documentary that I had him on. He was a co-director of that film some time ago, last year or so, maybe a little year and a half ago. And he's back on now with his co-director of a new project. That other director is Christopher Walker. And together they have co-directed a new documentary, a controversial one, called Welcome to Leith, which follows the story of white supremacist Craig Kopp, who decides to move to this tiny, tiny little burg in North Dakota called Leith and put down roots and create a community of white supremacists there. And it's what transpires during that period of time. And it's also what's kind of crazy is the filmmaker's relationship with Cobb and how that ends up happening. So this is a really, really cool conversation. The film is being distributed by First Run Features, and they're a wonderful art house film distributor. And thank you to First Run Features for sponsoring this episode. I value my relationship with First Run Features, a terrific company. And this is one of their latest films. Again, it's called Welcome to Leith. It will have its premiere in New York City on Wednesday, the 9th of September. It will be opening at the IFC Center. So a few days after Labor Day, you can just go over and check that out. And it will be playing in a number of other cities as well. It has gotten great reviews. It's played at the top festivals. So I highly recommend you go see Welcome to Leith, again, co-directed by my guests, Michael Beach Nichols and Christopher Walker, coming right up. And then that will be, again, followed by my conversation with Stanley. And last on this episode of FilmWax Radio, episode number 311, I am very happy to have talked to the filmmaker Oren Moverman, somebody who I've wanted on this podcast for years now. You may remember Oren from his past films he's directed, including The Messenger and Rampart. He has a new film now called Time Out of Mind. I saw it at the New York Film Festival last fall, and blew me away. It stars Richard Gere and everybody in this movie, including the star, Richard Gere, as well as his co-stars, Ben Vereen and Keir Sedgwick, all of them unrecognizable. I mean, so lost in their roles that you will barely recognize anybody in this film. It's almost like a documentary. It's about homelessness. It's about mental illness. It's very painful. Incredible performances. Very exceptional. It, too, opens September 9th, and Oren will also be on this episode of the podcast. Thank you to all of the filmmakers who have endeavored to come onto my podcast. I'm thoroughly blown away by the privilege of having them all on. And I urge you very, very, very strongly and honestly you to go see all three of these amazing, amazing films. So let's get on now with my conversation with Michael Beach Nichols and Christopher Walker, co-directors of this new documentary opening September 9th called Welcome to Leith.
When he first got here, he turned around and asked me, did we have any land for sale?
I had no idea what his ultimate plan was.
Well-known white supremacist Craig Cobb plans to turn Leith into a white nationalist community.
Here we can gather together and become a simple majority by legal electoral rights.
We live here, we breathe here, our kids grow up here.
Got you back.
All right.
No Nazis! No KKK!
That's white Americans hating on us, who are also white Americans.
This is what we sleep with every night.
They simply will not allow us to keep one another's company freely and openly.
Leave me alone.
You shall be, I will hit you.
He posts my name, my address. We gotta go.
We're here at the offices of First Run Features, distributor for Welcome to Leith, which is the documentary that we're here to celebrate today. As we speak today in mid-August, we're a couple few weeks from the theatrical premiere here in New York of Welcome to Leith. Is this September 9th? Okay, very good. Is that after Labor Day weekend? Mm-hmm. It is after Labor Day. I think it is. I think it's the Wednesday after the Monday. So anyway, I'm sitting with the two co-directors of the film, Michael Beach Nichols, who's back for his second time on the show. That's always fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Happy to welcome you back. But for the first time, because on the podcast, is this your first podcast, Christopher?
It's not my first podcast in general, but it's my first FilmWax.
Well, that I knew. I would like to get to the point where I don't remember how many, if anybody's been.
Yeah.
You've been on before? Then you know you've done a lot of shows, right? Mm-hmm. Christopher Walker, who is co-director. Now, is it basically such a close synergy of in terms of how you approach it, shooting, directing, producing, what have you, that you just put both your names on it? Like,
yeah, exactly. It is actually a close, very, very close process.
Right.
Because Mike shoots most of everything, you know, sort of like the A-cam, and I'm rolling sound. And
oh, okay.
And then if there's opportunities, I'm shooting a second camera, sometimes with the sound strapped to my chest.
So there were just the two of you?
Yeah.
It makes sense. This, you'll hear why those listening. And I'm going to give a little bit of brief synopsis because I want people to understand the context of why. You probably don't want to have a big crew in these settings.
Right.
Right?
Small.
I mean,
yeah.
Probably the two of you would have done it remotely if you could have figured out how at times. Anyway. Welcome to Leith is a feature documentary chronicling the attempted takeover of a small town in North Dakota. Now, what's nice about the first sequences of Welcome to Leith is you don't really know, and if you haven't done any due diligence, you don't even know necessarily. But that's not the way most people approach going to a movie, so I could give it away, right? Because you kind of know what's happening. I could not, but how are we going to talk about the film truthfully, right, if we don't talk about the basics of the premise, right? Or supremacist, as it were. You have to give it away.
Yeah, no, I think it's fine. Yeah, I think absolutely, because, yeah. I mean, it was a big news story. It was sort of an international
right.
story.
Oh, sure, yeah. That's true. It's just such a nice way into a movie. You know, I was really intrigued from the start. That was my experience, but I'll finish describing the story from the official language here that I'm reading from. So anyway, it's this chronicling the attempt to take over a small town in North Dakota by a notorious white supremacist named Craig Cobb. Who as Michael, you said, that it made torn from recent headlines. As his behavior becomes more threatening, tensions soar. and the residents desperately look for ways to expel their unwanted neighbor. Now, how many people in this town of Leith, because it's probably picked because there were so few people in the first place that they thought.
Exactly, yeah. There were 24, and that includes about 6 to 8 children, so about 16 adults total.
Wow, 16 adults in one town, and one of them is African-American, it turns out.
Yeah. Bobby Harper lived with his wife, Cheryl Harper.
Was she African-American?
No, she's not. She was, so they were an interracial couple.
Right.
And they lived...
The supremacists like that even more.
Yeah. No, they were put under a lot of stress. Absolutely. Yeah, it was definitely... Sure. We had a lot of sympathy for them.
Yeah. And so he moves in, and very quickly we figure out, he's up to no good. So the idea really is to populate the town with supremacists, right? To build roots.
Right, exactly. To democratically take over the town.
Oh, right. So when you say democratically, what do you mean? Because the film does explore what you just said.
Right. So, yeah, the idea was to bring enough people that shared his views in so then they could basically vote him in as mayor in the next electoral election.
Yeah. Wouldn't need a large number to do that.
And also just take over the council as well, so just council seats, so they sort of gain majority, and then it'd be easier for them to maintain majority in the council. Therefore, could vote in whoever, Cobb or whoever else, as the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of the overall goal.
Right. Well, how do you know each other, first of all?
Chris and I met in 2009 at Blowback Productions, working for Mark Levin and Mark Benjamin, who are documentary filmmakers that have been here in New York City for about 30 years. Chris hired me as an intern, actually. And we just became friends and started to work on another film, Fluxus Kings. Chris edited that film and was a producer on that film.
Okay.
And yeah, just really liked working together and decided to kind of create a production company and work together on our next project.
And then how did you first come upon the story and then like describe that part where you thought, this could be a good... documentary to pursue doing.
Yeah, we were looking for a story at that point, and then we just read about it in the New York Times, and I emailed the article to Chris, and I just said, this is, like, insane, like, check this out. And we just started sort of tracking it at that point. We thought that it would probably kind of fizzle because of the national spotlight, but about a month after we read the story, we heard that a family of white supremacists had moved in, and so we saw that there was a little bit of momentum on Cobb's side. So at that point, we just decided to call the mayor of the town to see if he'd be willing to talk to us, and he was. And so that was, once the mayor agreed, we decided to buy tickets and go out there, and we went out there a couple weeks later. And in between that time, a lot of other people from the town on the mayor's behalf called us and told us that they wanted to talk to us. And then we called Cobb a few days before we went out there to see if he'd speak with us. And he was actually out of town and was going to be out of town the entire time that we were there, here on the East Coast doing... a talk show where he was getting his DNA tested. That was the genetic testing.
His
ancestry.
That whole part of that, which we will not disclose, because
right,
I think that's a good thing to hold on to. Yeah,
but he was.
There's a clip in of it, right? There was the clip.
Yeah,
there.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
But yeah, it was just such a strange story taking place in this such a very small community of people that we really felt like we could go in and kind of talk to everyone in the town, and having it take place in sort of the middle of North Dakota. Visually seemed to us incredibly appealing. It just looked like this sort of desolate landscape on the plains. It was just really beautiful and sort of eerie, which really fit what was happening in the town. So cinematically, it offered a lot of opportunities to us as well.
Where were Cobb and where were they coming from? They were moving. They wanted to move there and plant roots, right? But where were they coming from?
So Cobb actually came from Canada. He was charged with hate speech in Canada. They have different laws there we have the First Amendment, where it kind of protects a lot of things, but over there it doesn't really. And so he actually left. He kind of, I don't want to say fled, but he just kind of took off.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up in Montana, and a woman named April Gayday was trying to do the same thing in Montana previous to Leith. And what that is it's called a PLE, a Pioneer Little Europe, which is sort of the goal is to set up an enclave, mm-hmm. an all-white enclave, to kind of leave the changing demographics of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The big draw or the big push from them is like they don't accept multiculturalism. They want to preserve the white race, and having these communities, they see would help them.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went there and he hung out there for a while. And I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I'm sure that kind of gave some inspiration. And then Leith was kind of perfect because of the Bakken oil boom that was happening not too far from there. And so he found this town that had so few residents that still had a city government, which you don't see very often. I mean, usually they're county incorporated, but it wasn't county incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
So he saw the small council, and it had a mayor and close proximity to jobs. And that was the draw, to get people out there, is they can get these well-paying jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And live in isolation, basically.
Wow. Was there any speech or rhetoric about doing anything aggressively against anybody, like or certain, you know, because that was historically kind of the problem. Isolation in of itself, I guess, you know, is right. A separate issue. But
yeah. I mean, not really. It was kind of... A lot of communication was done on the internet, on these sort of forums for like those places like VNN or Stormfront or something like that, where he was posting ads basically like, come live here, this is the draw.
Oh, I see.
And what was so fascinating was that it was so by the books, legally speaking.
Right.
And it was like, no matter who you are, you have a right to move wherever you want.
Mm-hmm.
He would often cite the Civil Rights Act of 1968 or 65 that kind of allows non-discrimination in housing. So, yeah, it wasn't any outward, no outward threats sort of at the beginning. It wasn't until, you know, Cobb kind of got there and the other family got there that the tension started to kind of boil.
Yeah.
I'd say, yeah.
The residents, locals, freaked out, understandably. Mm-hmm. Right. And, so what was your introduction to this guy like? I mean, what was that? What was it? Because you get a lot of access to him. I don't know if it was all consensual, but...
Yeah, we met him. The first time we actually met him in person was in jail. I'd had a few phone conversations with him before we went out, and then he wasn't there, like I said. And then we were going to make another trip in February. He was arrested in November. We spoke with him, you know, in jail, and then we went out there and we drove to the jail, which is a couple miles north of Bismarck,
mm-hmm.
So about 3 or 4 hours from Leith. And we met with him in jail, like through the glass, and he asked us, you know, if we were Jewish, that kind of thing, and you know, we just told him that we wanted to tell his side of the story. We'd spoken with everyone else in the town, and we wanted to, you know, speak with him as well. And he was sort of on the fence about it. He wasn't really clear if he was going to give us an interview or not. And we told him that, you know, we'd make an appointment with the jail and come back in a few days. And when we did, he was fine with it. So we met him for the first time, you know, in a jail, basically doing the interview. And yeah, I mean, it was pretty strange. Once he was released from jail, Chris and I weren't really sure, you know, where he would go. And we just decided, well, he'll probably just go to the parole office. So we just drove over to the parole office, and he was just there in the lobby. So we came outside, and we were speaking with him for a little bit outside, and the media kind of like came.
Oh, I see.
And he ducked back inside. And then a couple of minutes later, his parole officer came out, and he waved Chris and I in, and he just told us if we took our car around back, they would release Cobb to us, and we could just tell the media that he was just going to be in there for a while just to sort of get them away from him.
Mm-hmm.
So we were put in the strange position of being the only people that knew where he was staying in Bismarck for several months, and also having him in the car being released to us, which was a very strange thing. Obviously, as a documentary filmmaker, it's right. Incredible.
But now you're somewhat thrust now into this new, you have a new relationship with him, yeah, for all intents and purposes. Right.
It was a big paradigm shift. You know, person is in jail versus a person who's free, and how that changes as a filmmaker and the kind of access you have. And
yes,
it was very surreal.
Right. Yeah. So how did you process this relationship?
I don't think we didn't really have time, man.
You just thrown into it.
We had a limited amount of time that we could still stay in Bismarck because we were running out of money, and
mm-hmm.
we just shot as much as we could with them and wanted to get as much content as we could to help fill in the story, because we missed a little bit of it at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And Yeah, it was only after that I think we could really process.
Well, I mean, it was also, I mean, we were pretty much thrilled as storytellers to have this opportunity, because the whole time we thought he might just be in jail. And the jail, after the one interview that we had, the jail stopped granting interviews because a lot of media was contacting them and trying to do that. So all we knew we had was one interview with him, which was really going to be a difficult thing to make a film around. So when we were with him in the motel, I mean, we were just like, yeah, making up for lost time, like Chris said. And we just, you know, would spend like, we spent, I think, 3 days with him in the motel, about 8 or 9 hours each day, just there with him, just interviewing him, just talking about, you know, through all the sort of like story elements that we needed to have filled in. And then in between that, you know, we'd go to lunch with him in Bismarck, and he's this very well-known person. So we felt, you know, we'd bring the camera with us into the restaurant, just so it was sort of clear that we were filmmakers and there was sort of a relationship here that, you know, we weren't new recruits or anything like that.
Yeah,
to keep the lines drawn, I think. But yeah, I think like it was definitely sort of after all that. Like each night we'd kind of come back to our hotel and be pretty psychologically exhausted.
Yeah,
and, you know, you just, because sometimes he'd allow you to sort of forget who he was, and he's incredibly charming and articulate, and he would be just talking about something completely off topic, and then he'd come back and say something that was just, you know, really kind of terrifying.
Yeah, and I would imagine the instinct is to relate to somebody, you know, especially if you're interviewing them and you're around them, you know, it's not to I don't know. And also you need to, because they need to be able to trust you on some level to talk to you. So
yeah,
I could see how that could get murky. And
yeah, I mean, he's a person. I mean, he has these views that are just completely abhorrent and disgusting, but he's a person. He's opening up to us. He's allowing us to film him.
Right.
So you have this sort of very strange relationship.
So, I mean, added an extension of that, without in any way, I don't know, minimizing anything that, you know, that he stands for, but did you take away something that humanized him for you? I mean, other than obviously these candid moments where you're just sort of chatting about whatever.
Sure. I mean, I think we both came away with, you know, a real sense of loneliness on his part. I mean, it seemed like he's not in close contact with any of his family. It seems like he's
been ostracized.
Yeah,
completely.
Exactly.
But it would be easier just to live like anybody else. I mean,
right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, these views aren't making him a lot of friends necessarily at all.
Yeah. I was thinking about this. He's pushing back, you know, later scenes in the film, you know, against some of the locals who, you know, finally stand up to him, I guess, you know, and it's just like, you know, it's gotta be like, just so how do you keep up that anger and the, you know what I mean? That it's like gotta be exhausting. And at the end of the day, just sort of so unsatisfying a way to be, you know, and to live with yourself like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we definitely witnessed the sort of, you know, the pull of the internet and how much time he would spend online, and he would talk about that. I mean, there's a line in the film about how much time he liked to kind of spend online. And so I think in these forums, there is a sense of community, and it's just this kind of loop of outrage and feeling put upon and feeling like there's all this violence against white people. And it just becomes this sort of victimization, essentially just victimization and sort of commiseration amongst all these other people that have that feeling. And it just, if you're in that sort of vortex, it seems like it's hard to get out. For at least that's what we sort of witnessed with Cobb. I don't know if it's the same for everyone, but it definitely seems like it's a bubble.
Yeah. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah. And that's same for any sort of any politics. I mean, anyone on the left and the right, wherever. I mean, it's just something that the internet has brought us.
Yeah.
These communities that people can just communicate, and just like Mike said, just it becomes a vortex of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can sell each other the same line of whatever, because you're all part of the choir, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know. But last part is the question would be then, has he seen the film? And is he supporting the film, or is he going to participate on some level? Which kind of confuses things even more.
So we did, at Sundance, he did a Skype Q&A at Sundance.
Did he get booed?
He did get booed. It was an experiment, and, you know, the thought behind it was he participated, he's a person, we let him speak in the film, why not let him speak in a venue such as a Q&A? Like, why is it only for some residents and not him.
Well, I guess the question is he involving himself in the Q&A to support, advocate for the film or advocate for his agenda is the question. So is he,
sure.
You know, and those things, again, get murky.
Yeah, it gets murky.
And so many things.
Yeah, and I think...
more importantly, you didn't get booed. You got into Sundance, and you probably got a nice applause at the end.
It was a scene. Was it? You know, people at first kept it calm, and then it just kind of, people started screaming at the screen.
They did?
Yeah.
What kind of things?
I don't even really...
Were they angry, or were they
it
just...
people angry.
The film, or at...
At the idea that he'd be allowed to be...
Given a voice,
yeah.
So did you get that in your Q&As? I mean, I don't think... I remember running into you at Montclair, but I wasn't at that Q&A.
Yeah, I mean, we've gotten only positive feedback in terms of the film,
right.
What it is, and mm-hmm. how he's in it, and how he speaks for himself. Everyone loves that. But a lot of people, some people at that screening did not like that he was given that extra step
platform.
Of the Q&A, of the platform.
I understand. Yeah. So did he do any other since Sundance?
We haven't done any since then. We just felt like it wasn't very productive.
Right.
And
then it keeps the murkiness sort of not an issue and non-issue, right?
We've kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah, no, Cobb's not seen the film. We're screening the film. The film opens in Bismarck September 25th, and it plays for at least a week there. So Chris and I are flying out to North Dakota for that. It's a little bit unclear.
For the town of Leith can come up. And...
Yeah, and it's playing in another town called Mott. That's pretty close to Leith.
Okay.
Bismarck's about 70 miles away, and Mott is about 30 miles away. So that's the closest theater. So it's playing there on Saturday. We don't know if Cobb can come because Cobb cannot be within a certain number of feet of the people that were the victims of the terrorizing. So,
Which, again, go see the film in order to know what we're talking about there.
Right, yeah. So I don't think Cobb will be able to attend the screenings that happen on Friday and Saturday night.
I get you.
If any of those people are there.
Right. Oh, okay. I see.
Yeah. And we haven't been able to share the film with Cobb yet just because we haven't made it out there and we didn't.
All right. Well, you know, I made a joke to one of my guests recently that I had no listeners in either Dakota. I was trying to remember the segment because I just figured I don't have a single listener in either North or South Dakota. But maybe after this episode drops, that maybe I'll get a few.
Yeah, I can definitely think of a few that you'll get.
Yeah that might want to be interested in listening to you guys on the show. And again, on September 9th, Wednesday, September 9th, welcome to Leith, which is distributed by First Run Features and is co-directed by Michael Beach Nichols and Christopher Walker. And you have a broadcast coming up, spring of 2016?
Yeah.
Well, that's good. Well, you guys can come back for that. Just come back and do another... You know, we can come back. Well, that's good news. So for those who don't have the opportunity to get over to... But there might be a I'm sure there'll be... But there'll be a broadcast version of it, which is incredible for any documentary. It means a huge audience, which is nice. On Independent Lens, coming up next spring. That's good.
Yeah.
Great news. Yeah, let's keep in touch so at least I can promote it, remind people about it. Sounds good. All right, well, you know. Well, thanks. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Again, welcome to Leith. Thank you for First Run Features again for sponsoring the episode. Next up here again, my conversation with Stanley Nelson. This is a film that was funded by PBS, probably by way of ITVS, and it will eventually be on TV. But ignore all that, because what you need to do is go to the theater close to you where they're going to be playing this exceptional documentary, an important chapter of our history here in the United States. It's called The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, and get the full story about this incredible revolutionary, about this very important period of our country's recent history. My conversation with Stanley Nelson.
The Black Panthers.
Black Panthers.
Black Panther Party.
Black Panther Movement.
The Black Panthers were absolutely unique.
Being black in America meant that you didn't walk down the street with the same sense of safety and the sense of privilege as a white person. Attack dogs, fire hoses.
Police jump on you, beat you up, put the gun at your head. This is what we were going through on a daily basis.
We stand on the eve of a black revolution, brothers.
Now we have voices within the community that were not going to continue to turn the other cheek.
We want black power. We want black power.
Second Amendment guarantees the citizen a right to bear arms on public property.
We're going to carry our guns and we're going to follow the police. We're going to maintain a legal distance, ready to throw down if necessary.
Anyone who would approve of this kind of demonstration must be out of their mind. God help yourself!
Gestapo pigs have to stop brutalizing our community or we're going to drive them out.
Majority of the rank and file are women.
We tried to change some of the clear gender roles. Women had guns and men cooked breakfast for children.
The way we walk and talk and dress, we were a phenomenon. Stand
alert! The Black Panthers really understood the media. They used us to their advantage.
Chairman of the Black Panther Party, and here he is.
They tapped the phone. The phone is probably hooked up to the White House.
You read the Black Panther Party newspaper?
Yes, I do.
Why?
Because I'm black and I'm proud.
The FBI wanted to destroy the Panthers.
How about justice? Justice is incidental to law and order.
This was all-out attack on the Black Panther Party. Every significant office is going to be raided, bombed, shot, mass arrests.
They were coming to kill us.
When the 15-minute gun battle was over, two Black Panthers were dead.
This was obviously a political assassination.
It was like a slaughterhouse.
We were doing fundraisers at places like Jane Fonda's townhouse so that we could raise money for the Legal Defense Fund.
There were 156 not guilty verdicts. It's astonishing.
We don't hate nobody because of their color. We hate oppression.
We refer to ourselves as the Vanguard. We wanted the entire community to follow.
I feel free. I feel absolutely free. You understand? That's what I feel.
Hold the mic up right there. Okay. Like, because the closer, the warmer. And hold up a little higher, like on the handle, just because it tends to. Also, I got to replace all my equipment.
Let me.
Remember RAM. Thank you for, even in the general sense, I like to thank people for sitting with me, and definitely somebody who I've wanted to talk to for a long time. Ooh, careful. It's definitely somebody I've... There goes Stanley. All right. I promise.
I wanted to talk to him, but I can't now because he's died.
Yeah, fan of your work and your mission. It seems like you and Firelight Media, you founded this, right?
Yes, me and my wife.
You both. What's your wife? Who's your wife?
My wife is Marcia Smith.
Marcia Smith. And she's a filmmaker as well.
Yeah, she's actually is a film writer and wrote a bunch of the films that we do and kind of now runs the whole thing that we do and kind of keeps everything working.
Would you say that you have a mission, or with Firelight Media you have a mission to tell a more far-reaching or maybe a larger story than each specific film?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, could be summed up in world domination. I mean, that's actually our mission.
Fair.
But besides that, I think that, you know, we're trying to tell a different set of stories than you know, is out there sometimes in the mainstream and try to get, you know, different people involved in filmmaking. Mm-hmm. You know, there's people of color, you know, and try to get people involved in the industry in other ways. But, you know, I don't look at it like I have a mission. You know, I think that each film is separate. You know, if you add them all up, it might look like a mission, but it would probably be an accident.
Don't get me wrong, like not agenda, like you're trying to push your agenda over on people, but just like an artistic idea, you know?
Yeah, I mean...
Which has some political side to it, and it has a social side to it, has... historical side to it.
Yeah, I think that for me, you know, it anything I do comes out of the fact that, you know, I grew up in the 50s, believe it or not, in 60s. And at that point, you know, you didn't see anybody African-American on TV at all and very rarely in the movies. And it's hard to, you know, for people who are younger to imagine that you saw African-Americans, Latinos, Asians. You never saw them on TV or in films. I mean, I mean, you know, never, not in the commercials, not in the situation comedies, not in the Western, you know, nothing. So I came out of that and you know, all of a sudden in the 70s, there were these blaxploitation films being made. It was like, well, wait a minute, we can get into it. But at that point, the stories that were being told weren't the stories of the people that I knew. You know, it was stories of you know, pimps and prostitutes and hustlers and people shooting each other. And that, those weren't the people that I knew. So I wanted to tell stories of the people that I knew.
Mm-hmm. And so what was the beginning of that then? When, what was the first project that got your career going?
The first film that I made, the first independent film I made, was a film called $2 and a Dream about Madam C.J. and Lelia Walker. Madam C.J. Walker had a cosmetic company that started in 1910, and it was the first really large cosmetic company that was geared towards African-American women.
Yeah, one of these incredible stories that certainly nobody paler complexion.
At that point I made the film, which we finished in maybe 1989, something like that. Not very many African Americans knew about the story, and so it was a story that wasn't as widely known. It's kind of known now, but there have been a couple of books that were written since, but it wasn't known back then. And also there were a lot of other things that she did. So the people who worked for the company, who ran the company, were all women. These were all black women. And mm-hmm. It was a way to give, black women a chance to make some money with some dignity. You know, you didn't have to go clean houses or something like that. So it was a bit different from the opportunities that were out there.
Normally I would go into a great detail, but we're going to jump over to,
okay.
to respect your time. Maybe we'll do a part two some other time.
That'd be great. Anytime.
Thank you. So it seems as though the Black Panthers has been in the fringes of a lot of other documentaries and stories over the last decade plus or whatever, both in the narrative as well as the documentary worlds. So now this is probably the first time there's been something that's been both focusing completely on that as the entire storyline of them, as well as and something that's going to be seen by a lot of people, something that's going to be distributed more broadly.
I hope so. That's what we're looking for.
Yeah.
I think that when we started the film, we talked to people and they go, well, why do you want to do the Black Panthers? Hasn't there been so much done on them? And I was like, what film was that? I'd say, well, which film are you talking about? And then people would start to like, well, wait a minute, The Panthers have been part of a lot of films, that they've been the background to other films.
A chapter in the film.
There hasn't been, in any film that was kind of the rise and fall of the Black Panther Party, which is kind of what we're trying to do in this film.
Part of the story, which I think maybe now is the time to tell it, because maybe now there isn't quite the critical look at that trying to, it isn't quite a threat, maybe. I could be naive, but I don't think it's as much of a threat. In other words, I think that there's been a lot of energy put into trying to sabotage and to show, well, there were a lot of fractions and people, it was about, different leaders turning against each other, and there wasn't solidarity, there wasn't a unity there. Well, we see that actually there was, but there was also very, larger than life figures that did have a complicated lives and relationships, but that there was a passion and there was a center to it. That's also kind of a new thing.
Yeah, I think what we wanted to try to do was tell the story warts and all, how do you tell this story? Well, there were problems from within the party, and problems with the personalities in the party, and maybe that's just something that happens, all the time, mm-hmm. when you have these larger than life personalities, how many rock groups are, last forever,
right.
it's really hard. But there were these kind of rock star personalities in the Panthers. So I think that was essential, but also we wanted to show that there were also these tremendous pressures from without, so the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover, mm-hmm. The local police departments were putting this incredible pressure, on the Panthers, and some of it was very covert. Nobody knew that COINTELPRO existed. And the other thing is that it's important to understand that the Panthers were really young. So you have these kids.
It's incredible.
These young people who are under this extreme pressure, and they're in these life and death situations. They're infiltrated by with crazy informers and agents, provocateurs who are saying do this, do that. Mm-hmm. And also you have this leadership that starts fighting among themselves. It was just an incredibly volatile situation.
Mm-hmm. What was that process like, rounding up the surviving members?
You know, I think one of the things that, served us was that it took so long to make the film. It took us Did 7 years to kind of raise the money and make the film. Yeah. And so, you know, the people who, you know, we approached in the first year and they were like, you know, I don't think so. We approached them in the second year. They're like, well, maybe the third year. They're like, you guys still around?
Still around, you know, I guess
the fourth year.
It.
Like, yeah. I guess these guys are really serious, you know, yeah. they're still here.
Or they felt bad for you. Like, okay, right. obviously this is... They need a leg up here.
Yeah, let's help these guys out. But, you know, and I think the other thing that happens is, you know, people talk to each other and say, you know, hey,
yeah.
these guys, they're okay. You know, they don't seem to be trying to exploit us as other people have. And then, you know, social media has helped because people can kind of, you know, sure. see who you are. And they can go.
Doing due diligence is a lot easier.
Yeah, it's just a couple of taps. Press a button and it's like, oh, okay, this is what this person has done. This is, you know.
So. Yeah. All right, so a lot of those, the former Black Panthers they're still very close in touch. Is that your sense that they're...
It ranges, you know, it ranges from you know, there's a Panther alumni organization that's trying to pull more people together. There's a certain faction of Panthers who do not communicate with anybody, you know, or one or two people. Mm-hmm. They don't want to talk about it. They've kind of disappeared. There's that faction. There's some who are kind of very out there, you know, who are collecting any kind of Panther memorabilia and really
made it a
center of their lives even today. So it really runs the gamut of where they are.
It has to be very bittersweet because you know you are part of a chapter in contemporary history of the country and at the same time it was such a family, a rock band, a family. Which, when it's over, has got to feel extremely like you're unanchored. I got that sense from a couple of the guys talked about. They felt adrift afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most amazing things for us in the film and in the research is we found these exit letters that Panthers wrote.
Yeah, that was
kind of dear Huey that we use at the end, you know, and they're just amazing,
heart wrenching.
You know? Yeah, you know, dear Huey, I love the Panthers, but I need to spend more time with my family. I want to spend more time with my kids. I can't stand being poor anymore.
I can't live impoverished like that. It's a commitment that you can wear at you. Over, you know, you can do it for so long. And it's another reason why, I guess, why it was run by young folks, because they hadn't entered into families quite yet, possibly. Also, I mean, it was kind of a practical thing. And how do they feel like it came out? The ones that participated or passed? I'm sure you've done some private screenings.
Well, I think one of how did the film come out? Or how did
I know how the film came out. It came out, by the way, pretty damn good. We're just going to put that out there. By the way, as we're talking on a Monday evening, it's coming out. It's going to be playing theatrically at the Film Forum in New York City on Wednesday, the 2nd of September. And then up at the Magic Johnson, AMC Magic Johnson in Harlem.
So it's that Film Forum for 2 weeks.
And then
9/11, which is you can't forget. It's 9/11.
Yeah.
It goes to Magic Johnson in Harlem, which is great because that's kind of my neighborhood theater. You know.
Yeah.
We walked over there. Me and my son walked over there 2 weeks ago to see a movie.
Which one?
What's that woman's name? Amy Schumer. Is that?
Oh yeah, the comedy.
Train wreck.
Okay.
We bought some popcorn and.
A popcorn movie.
We bought some popcorn. It was great. It was a very hot 90-something degree day. We bought some popcorn, sat in the air conditioning, and it was great.
So my question was, before I switched over to help promote the screenings, was just about the reaction to the folks that did participate and support the film, the former Black Panthers, the alumni. What was their response to the finished film?
Oh, the response has been incredible. You know,
they were happy with it and how the organization was portrayed.
So probably, you know, one thing the first thing we did was we showed the film to kind of the people who were in the film, you know, here and in LA and in the Bay Area, and you know, wanted them to see the film first. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what it is. You know, here it is. We actually sat in this very room and had like eight Panthers here who saw the film here, and you know, so and then we were at festival. We've been at film festivals, so. Mm-hmm. Maybe I would say 100 Panthers have seen the film, and we've gotten two who don't like it, but the rest have been good. So, you know,
you can probably say that's negligible. Yeah.
Those are good odds, you know. You know, so 98 out of 100.
How many,
those are good odds.
How many are there
Panthers
that we know about?
You know, I am not sure. I would say that, you know, we're talking in, you know, 400, 500, 600. You know, probably who are around.
Yeah, because they were so young. They're probably just around 60 or early
70,
60s.
Early, okay. Late, middle 60s, 70s. You know, and you know,
right,
in terms of film interview, mm-hmm. you know, film interviews, they're vibrant. You know, those are people who can remember this time. I remember a time that was central in their lives, and a lot of them. You know, nobody asked them their story. I mean, you would never know what they were doing almost 50 years ago. And so, you know, when I ask them, you know, they just go back there, and it's just amazing to see.
Is it your sense then that they, from talking to them and maybe getting to know a certain number of them, do you get a sense that they felt the mission was kind of like they accomplished something that they did? I mean, their mission was at the time was to overthrow the government as it existed, which it needed to do good. They were not anti-white. They were just anti-hate and anti-bigotry. Do they feel in retrospect that they made a big difference?
I think they feel that they made a big difference. I think that you know, their difference in a large way was cultural. You know, we're living in a, I mean, and that if you look at the kind of that movement, so many of the movements that were part of that, you know, 60s, late 60s, mm-hmm. 70s, you know, it's the changes are cultural. We live in a different cultural time. You know, the Panthers, you know, had a 10-point program that, you know, included, you know, a call for the end of police violence, you know, better housing for Black people, a complete end to unemployment for Black people, you know, those kind of things, better schools. You know, those problems are still just where they were 50 years ago. You know, we live in a different time culturally. So I think, you know, I was really surprised at pretty much how clear-eyed most of the Panthers that we talk to see it, you know, that they, you know, they'll talk about, well, we started the breakfast program that's now been picked up by the government. And now everybody understands that you need to have a breakfast program for kids. And believe it or not, the government was not doing that before the Panthers did it. But, you know, they would say, no, we didn't, you know, we lost, you know, we fought a battle and we fought a good fight. But no, you know, we lost.
The Black Panthers is the name of the documentary.
Vanguard
of the Revolution, directed by Stanley Nelson. And good luck with it.
We'll be showing is if you go to theblackpanthers.com, and that's simple, theblackpanthers.com, mm-hmm. and it has, you know, the schedule not only in New York, but the right. schedule all around the country. It's going to 20 cities around the country, and almost every place we go, we're having guests almost, you know, every evening. And so, you know, in New York, we're having Jamal Joseph, who went to jail with the Panther 21. We're having lawyers for the Panthers. We're having a great photographer, Steve Shames, who took the incredible pictures that we use in the film. Other Panthers, we're doing the same thing in, you know, Chicago, L.A., wherever we go, we're having guests. And also, believe it or not, I'm going to all 20 cities.
I don't believe that.
It's true. I'm going to all 20 cities to at least be at one screening in the opening weekend.
That's terrific. So check it out. Again, theblackpanthers.com and check screenings, the link for screenings, I assume. And you can find out if it in fact is playing in your city and then prepare for a very interactive
It should be great.
Go when you're there, of course.
Yeah, no, it'll be great to do the Q&A. Yeah. That's the gravy of
sure.
making films, is to be able to see with an audience. But I should also say one last thing is that, you know, for me, I've been making films for almost 40 years, and this is the first theatrical distribution that I've ever had. This is the first real theatrical
right.
distribution.
It has been mostly television?
Yeah, they've been television. We've done, you know, a lot of festivals. We've been,
right.
you know, and you know, had a lot of festivals and done, you know, individual screenings. But these are like, you know, we're at the Magic Johnson Theater all day, every day, you know, at 2, at 4, at 6, you know.
You can do little drive-bys.
Yeah, I'm going to, believe me.
I believe you. Well, after you get back from that, your tour, let's do it, because I'm interested also talking about from the business standpoint and being a documentary filmmaker going back that long, your experiences and how you've kept up and all that kind of stuff.
I would love to do it. I would love to do it.
Okay. Well, we'll let you. We'll get also your sort of stories from traveling around and all that. But thanks a lot for being late to dinner and squeezing this in.
Yeah, it's my wife's birthday, so it's not just dinner.
That's bigger. Okay. Right. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Okay, folks, Oren Moverman, born in Israel, but has become a major filmmaker in the last few years through a series of high-profile films, including, as I mentioned, The Messenger, followed by one of my favorite movies in a long time called Rampart, and now Time Out of Mind. I urge you to go see Time Out of Mind and those two other films if you haven't seen them, and get to know this really, really talented filmmaker, Oren Moverman. And here is him, Oren, in fact, just moments after I met Richard Gere. But I told you about that in a past episode. But here it is again, my recounting, my celebrity run-in. This time I tell Oren about it, and then we talk about the film.
Jesus Christ. Who the hell are you?
For you, dear, I was born.
Are you and have you been addicted to any legal or illegal substances?
For you, I was raised up.
How about family? You got family?
For you, I've lived. For you, I will die. For you, I'm dying. You told me you'd stick by me.
Normally it's, you know, the parents takes care of the kid.
Through the thick and through the thin.
This is a weird phenomenon that happens where I have, almost every time I meet somebody, and I don't know if you had this feeling already, but I get this every day almost, which is, you look familiar. I get it all the time. It's very strange, to the point where it's not so strange. It's like typical, and I don't really think about it too much. So this time, I was just sitting there waiting to talk to you, and Gere comes through, and he smiles, makes eye contact, and he goes, "Do we know each other?" And I said, "Yes, no, I mean, I know, because, you know, for a moment I was actually starstruck, which never happens. I mean, rarely happens. What is
it?" He has a glow about him that is touched
by... I call
by
it the Bill Clinton kind of phenomenon.
It's this charisma that just radiates out of him. He can't help it. He's not trying to do it. It's just there, and he's a movie star for 40 years.
Yeah. I was just talking to somebody out there also in the lobby that when I was in high school or junior high school, probably junior high school, I was in grammar school and
nursery.
He was in Bent, and I grew up here in New York City. Where'd you grow up, by the way?
Israel.
Oh, you grew up in Israel?
Yeah.
Haifa?
Tel Aviv.
Tel Aviv. But anyway, so I just remember him bursting out on the scene on Broadway. So everybody here in New York knew Richard Gere from Bent. And then in the next couple of years, Looking for Mr. Goodbar and a couple of the other films.
Days of Heaven.
Well, of course, Days of Heaven.
American Gigolo.
American Gigolo, right. Yeah. And on and on and on and never
ended. Pretty Woman.
What a career.
Yeah.
Well, that was a little later, but you can think of
those are like the touchstones.
The touchstones, right. And there are very few actors that you could think of or name have that kind of career, right?
Officer and Gentleman, let's not forget.
Oh, my God, right. That was huge. Huge. Yeah. Wow, he just keeps coming back. And now Time Out of Mind.
No.
Let's look.
Just kidding.
I saw this at the New York Film Festival last year. It was just like this little quiet evening. I usually go to press screenings, but I went to a public screening of it at the Film Center, the Buena Monroe Film Center.
And was I there?
You were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With Bobby Bukowski, the DP. Yeah.
Yes, you were there.
That was
and I was very tempted to wait it out and introduce myself afterwards because I was going to say I do this little dinky podcast. On indie film, would you come on it? You know, and impatiently figuring, well, probably this day would happen eventually anyway, but so I'm glad it did.
Me too.
And I'm glad I saw the film. In addition to Gear, and I guess I remembered vaguely before I went that Ben Vereen was in it, but it took me about halfway, not halfway, but a good 15, 20 minutes to put it together that that's Ben Vereen.
Yeah, it's remarkable that way.
It's remarkable.
He sort of disappeared into this character.
Yeah.
You know, I think he sort of disappeared for a lot of people anyway. You know, people really haven't seen Ben Vereen in a movie in a substantial role for a long time.
Yeah.
He had like a scene in a Chris Rock movie, you know, the last one, Top Five.
Oh, right, yeah, which I did see, but I'm trying.
Played his father.
Okay.
Forgettable scene.
Blink your eyes.
And yeah.
Yeah. Which is a crime, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, so, no, he's really an underused actor who I think he makes a lot of decisions not to be used that much. He does stage stuff. He has his own show. He'll do performances. He chooses not. I mean, he was on TV for a while on How I Met Your Mother and things like that.
Oh, okay.
But in terms of his film work,
yeah,
he sort of disappeared for a while.
Right. Yeah. Well, he was iconic, so, you know, after Roots and there seemed to be, you kept seeing him everywhere for into the 80s. And then,
but his life got really complicated. I don't know if you know the stories about the accident and the...
Not all, but...
Strokes, and I mean, he was never going to walk again. And this amazing dancing man was told that he was never going to walk again, and he rebuilt himself, and he's dancing now and singing and performing. Had to learn how to talk again. You know, I mean, he went through hell, and he's remarkable. He functions at all, and on this level, it's even more remarkable.
Well, now that you talk about it, in the context of Ben Vereen specifically, because I'm curious to know, because of the type of characters that Richard and Ben are playing, I should say they're both homeless men from very different circumstances, but they become, through Ben's character, the character's name?
Dixon.
Dixon's tenacity, perfect word for that. They kind of become friends, and maybe more reluctantly on Richard Gere's character's side. Right. But anyway, I'm wondering like how Ben felt about doing that work, and it was everybody's very raw in this movie.
Yeah,
I mean, and maybe no one more than Keir Sedgwick, but that's something else I'll mention later.
Yeah, well, the story with Ben was really interesting and very much in the spirit of how this movie was made. We sent the script out to a few actors. We had different ideas in mind. I haven't seen Ben Vereen in anything in a long time, so I had a good feeling about him because of, you know, he's a legend, but I didn't know how he would respond to the script. And I got a call that he wants to come to New York to meet. He's in L.A. He's doing rehearsals for something, but he wants to meet face-to-face. And I said, quite protectively, I said, well, let me talk on the phone with him first. He doesn't need to get on a plane to see me. You know, for this, we can talk, and then we could meet if it works out. And the answer came back as no. He doesn't want to talk on the phone. He wants to sit in the room with you. And he'll come for 2 hours in the middle of rehearsals. He'll just come to New York, sit in the room with you, and then go back to the airport. So I did not know what to expect. He walks into the room. He's Ben Vereen. I'm kind of nervous and happy to meet him. And he sits down and he says, let me explain to you why I need to play this role. And he did. He just told me things about his life, told me things about where he is in life right now. And he said, I need to play this role. And then he read from the script. He did scenes from the script and took direction.
That he had memorized?
No, he had it in front of him.
Yeah, no difference.
Yeah, he had it in front of him. It was almost like an audition, except that it was a voluntary audition. You know, like I didn't ask him to read anything. He just did. And we taped it. I sent it to Richard, who's also a producer on the film. I said, I think we have him. And Richard said, he's our guy. It was very clear that there was something going on inside him that needed to be expressed in this character and that he was going to fight for it and get it.
Well, let's take another example of that, because none of these actors who are very glamorous, they're all shown in a small film, you know, in terms of scale. Not, I mean, this is a great film, but for Keir Sedgwick to go that far in this type of film where she may not get the exposure. Like, what will this do for her career? In other words, so it was, I think, a big risk thing, you know, for her. Not in any way to demean your film at all.
No, no, no. I totally agree with you. Her story was really interesting because the role itself, as written, was a homeless woman he meets and has a brief relationship with and moves on. And I met with, I think her agent called me and said, you know, Kira wants to work with you, and she's kind of interested in this role, and the subject matter is interesting to her. And I met with her, and I said, sure, this makes a lot of sense. I mean, I was surprised and delighted, but it was not, there was nothing in the role, even in terms of dialogue. There were like three lines of dialogue. Mm-hmm. And then she went out and did the research. She talked to women. There was some sort of a meeting organized for her with homeless women where it was just her and the women just asking questions and hearing stories. And then we met again, and she took out this notebook, and she said, I met this amazing woman, and I took some notes. And she read to me what this character was saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, could you send that to me? I'd like to work with that. And I took...
So the part expanded too.
We added three scenes.
Yeah.
And basically a monologue for her,
yeah,
where she just gets to go for it. But it all came from her. It wasn't, I mean, I shaped it a little bit, but it was all from her conversation with this woman where she felt like, I now found someone, not only I can model myself on this person, but I can actually express something on behalf of women like that through this one monologue. And so we did it. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the beauty of making, as you say, a small independent film where we have the control of it, and Richard is a producer on it, and I get to write the script and to work with the actors to make the script better and make everybody look better, is when this kind of contribution comes in and it makes the sequence, it makes the character, it makes everything, you know, fit for those moments. And so... that's an enormous contribution, not only of an actor coming in saying, I'll do something small and perhaps that will disappear in a movie, but also contributing to what the movie is about in a true way.
Also the Buscemi brothers, a few other great, that's a great cast. Janna Malone, excuse me, should be mentioned. How does a movie this size get made? Like, I understand normally you'd say, well, I have Richard Gere, so that, and he's a producer, so that helps, obviously helps find money, no doubt. But then to do this film, which again is, it's not like a star vehicle. It's really experimental. I mean, the obviously the camera work is a lot of stolen shots.
Nothing stolen, but there were a lot of live environment shots.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I would imagine you'd need to do stolen shots.
No, everything was permitted. We actually insisted on doing it.
Yeah, right. No. It was right around the time I had also seen the Safdie Brothers film, which explored also people living on the edge, where drugs and alcohol is often an issue and things like that, and homelessness. That was all stolen shots. It were mostly very different. But anyway, yeah, so like, how do you make a film this size? Was that a... and then IFC comes aboard to distribute. Did everybody just buy into it? Like Richard Gere making a very different film. This is like an anti-hero, you know, of sorts.
Yeah, I think it's possible. Look, it doesn't hurt that you have a movie star at the center of the movie. It's a very different role, as you say, and it's not glamorous, and it's not a hero, and it's not sexy. So there has to be a different approach to it. If you keep it small enough, you know, there are sort of business type reasons to make a movie like this. But I think this particular case goes beyond it, because I do think that the people who were involved in financing the movie and producing it were people who cared about the issue. And so they saw it not
mental
only... Mental illness and homelessness.
And homelessness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which are often...
connected.
Hand
absolutely.
In hand. Yeah.
Is there
an issue that could have taken place in Tel Aviv? Is this a film that could
nowadays?
Take place? Nowadays,
nowadays, okay. Yeah. Like when I was growing up, there were no homeless people. But Israel is now a very different country on many different levels, including economically. And the disparity between the rich and poor is actually one of the most extreme in the Western world. And so nowadays, you see homeless people on the streets of Tel Aviv, where
You didn't.
You never did.
A couple of decades back.
But this particular movie is also about a society, New York, where there's a right to shelter, which is a very different concept than most places in the States. So it has particular New York elements to it.
Right.
But the people who were involved, I think, really cared about the issue and saw an opportunity not only to make a movie, which has its business application, but also make a movie that matters. And, of course, the audience will be the judge of that. But I think that was a lot of the motivation behind the people who made making this movie possible.
Was Gear also, was it in this bio where maybe the first words are humanitarian? Yeah, humanitarian before actor. So I know that that's the way he perceives himself. Well, or would like to think. I mean, who wouldn't? I mean, of course, it's more important to be humanitarian. So
yeah,
but I'm just
but not every movie star is.
No, right. Even though
he's someone who's been active.
He walks the walk. No. I mean, and this might be another example because you don't necessarily see it in the films that he stars in. But this is clearly an exception because he's playing a homeless person with mental illness. It's a tragedy, and you know, there's no happy ending in this film. And yet it is it's entertaining and funny. There's a lot of humor in it. And really, yeah, just intriguing. I really do hope a lot of people do go see it.
Thank you. Just send them.
I will. Well, hopefully, you know. And I'm hoping I said Time Out of Mind, which is, by the way, a great Bob Dylan album. Is no surprise to you, I'm sure.
No, that's not where we took the title from.
Where is that originally from? Is that Shakespeare or something?
It is Shakespeare.
It is Shakespeare.
You know, when you say it's Bob Dylan, you know it's going back
Bible
to Shakespeare.
It's either Bible or Shakespeare.
But it's also British law, ancient law, which actually also is called Time Immemorial, mm-hmm. which is really about... time that exists beyond memory,
mm-hmm.
Which we thought was sort of fitting for this character.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know Richard Gere got lost in the role in a lot of ways and that he was often mistaken for a homeless guy, right, when the camera wasn't around. And,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, it must have been quite it must have shaken him up a bit. Like,
yes, I would say he was definitely shook up, especially the first time we... went out to the streets and had him panhandle in Astor Place, and no one would look at him.
Right. Yeah, yes.
Which is a very tough thing for an actor to do. So
I hear the invisibility is soul-crushing. Let me ask you, now that we're on the subject of the anti-hero, your films, Rampart, which I was also a really big fan of. I really like that movie.
Thanks.
Yeah, with Woody Harrelson's in it. Another anti-hero, to say the least, in that movie. Winding down here, what compels you to make films about guys like these? As different as the two characters are, which right. vary, of course.
I don't know. I think the flaws, the emotional flaws in human beings are what makes them interesting. And I think that these three films in particular, The Messenger, Rampart, and Time yes. of the Mind, are really all about men, different ages. They get older from movie to movie. and they're yeah. all taking place in male institutions, you know, whether it's the military, the police department, or in this particular case, a male homeless shelter.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, at least in these three, it was interesting to explore masculinity or the male persona
right.
as it breaks down.
Yeah.
As it no longer is sustainable in a world that is harder to understand, harder to function in, and where emotions bump up against, you know, functioning in the world. And to me, that's interesting.
It's a good answer. And Grant, you know, we all look back at our granddads. Life seemed simpler. You know, the man was the breadwinner. He was the leader. He was, you know, it seemed to be a bit clear cut. It's a little harder to be clear cut.
Yeah.
It's less clear cut these days.
Well, and in a world where you're expected to be more aware of your emotions and deal with them, you know, that the theater of male behavior kind of breaks down. As you say, the grandfather... that generation of men who just went on with their lives and just did what had to be done, ignoring a lot of things that would have maybe improved their lives or made their lives more pleasant, but they just took on a lot of hits and just kept going. I think the modern-day male persona deals more openly with emotions and with the place of that in a modern world or in a more progressive world. And I think that's where the male facade kind of breaks down. And I think the breaking down of that is an interesting thing to explore. Definitely makes for drama.
Good drama. Time Out of Mind opens Wednesday, September 9th in New York City, probably at the IFC Center, among other places, I'm guessing.
Yep.
And then in Los Angeles on the 11th, Friday the 11th, and on and on. Thank you. I have wanted you on the show, this podcast, for a long time, actually. I'm glad to finally.
I'm on it. Thank you.
Come back again.
Anytime.
Okay.
My pleasure.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
You don't like yourself. You're depressed. You don't believe in yourself. So what's society supposed to do with you? Why should they care?
Would you ever care for me?
I've been feeling for the last 10 years, maybe.
Were you ever there for me?
That I am just one stupid loser of an idiot.
You who are.
And I'm just not so sure anymore. Am I homeless?
No. You just reduced.
Am I homeless?
You reduced on your way up, George. That's
I'm
all
homeless. I don't exist.
You reduced.
We don't exist.
So far from me. Far from me.
Thanks, everybody. What an incredible show, right? Show your support to me and write that little review on my iTunes page. Please go there to Filmwax Radio. You've already subscribed, I assume, but if you would, go to iTunes, search Filmwax Radio, and then subscribe if you haven't already. And, of course, leave a review, star rating. It's all very, very much appreciated, and it really helps the podcast. So there should be hundreds of them. I mean, reviews or star ratings. And I don't know why there isn't. I really don't understand it. Other podcasts, people seem to do it. Mine, for some reason, you listen. I know you're listening, but you're not taking that extra moment or two. What's up with that? I mean, you know, I'm not going to get on you about it, but, it would be an enormous help to me. And show your appreciation for what I'm doing. It's not like I can live off this, you know, podcast. I can't. But one day, that's the plan. Because it's my love, it's my passion, and it means it. I mean, I know people listen to it, and that means so much to me. So show your appreciation in a very, very tactile way, very practical way, and that is by going to iTunes, subscribe, star rating, review. Okay? It just takes a minute or two of your time, and yet it means so much to me. And you can go to Facebook and you can like our page. It's facebook.com/filmwaxradio. We're on Twitter @filmwaxradio. And we're on Instagram, all these things. So you can connect with me in all sorts of ways. You can go to the website, filmwaxradio.com, and you can send a message. Send me, are you a filmmaker? I'm getting your emails. Send me that. Or you can write me and you can tell me somebody you want me to invite onto the show. I've got a list as long as my arm. Or if you know a well-known filmmaker, if you know somebody who is, an amazing artist, put me in touch with them. Why not? Or somebody who would just be a great guest. I'm open to suggestions. I may not take it, but I'm open to it. All right, guys. That's my show, episode number 3. Okay, next episode, if you're still listening, we have on Roger Corman. I mentioned that. You know, just throwing that out there. A Canadian filmmaker from Toronto that I interviewed last year, and I'm finally getting this on the show. His name is Alan Zweig. He's a very singular documentary filmmaker, makes very personal docs, and he's based in Toronto. And finally, I'm going to put that up. And then lastly, the author Duane Epstein, who wrote a great book, a great biography on the actor Lee Marvin. I meant to put this up already, but everything got turned around, as it often does. But we're finally going to put up my conversation with Duane Epstein. And if you like the conversation, I read the book. I did, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. It's called Lee Marvin, Point Blank. And all those will be on the next episode of the podcast, and on and on and on and on. Thank you, everybody. This is Adam Chartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Have a great Labor Day holiday. And we'll be back after that. Get down! Get down!
to attack you, attack that statue. Would you dare?